Thank you very much, and I echo Jonathan's and John's comments about the importance of having a debate. I think perhaps boringly, I'm going to agree with quite a lot of what they've said, but hopefully I'll be able to illustrate them, the points in a slightly different way with some other examples as well, which hopefully bring to home some of the issues and allow us to have a good debate afterwards. So in the next 50 minutes or so, I'll basically argue that GDP, despite all of its problems, is a useful aggregate indicator for us to be looking at when we think about economic prosperity and we think about economic growth. The problem really comes when we use it for the wrong kind of thing, and we misuse or abuse the numbers that come out of GDP measurement. And what we need to do about that is be conscious about how we use it, but also to complement it and modernize it, as was earlier mentioned already, for the modern economy. So one of the nice things about GDP is that we kind of know it and we love it. So, you know, we also know what's wrong with it. And there's a lot of things that GDP does not capture that are good and that it measures that are bad. And so this is a summary, so it's not even comprehensive, but there are a lot of things on the top left-hand side, good things that are not included in GDP that we kind of care about. Some of them economic, some of them more social. And there are a lot of bad things, such as wars or accidents or whatever, that actually, in the way that GDP is measured, would push it up, actually. So when we're looking at GDP metrics, we need to understand what's going underneath the bonnet and understand to what degree it's actually good things that are pushing it up versus bad things that are pushing it up. So obviously, I won't be able to cover all of those, but there are a couple of these that I wanted to just highlight in a little bit more detail, because I think they are very important. And when we come to interpret GDP numbers, it's important that we keep those things in mind. So the first one is around some of the topics that Jonathan and John have already raised. And I'd quite like to actually start by challenging the exam question we have been given. The exam question was, is GDP a good measure for looking at economic growth? But is economic growth really what we all care about, or the only thing we care about? Is it the objective function? Well, obviously not. And there are other things that people actually put over and above of economic growth when you ask them. Or when you ask them how well they're doing, there are other things that correlate better with their well-being than economic growth. And health and employment are actually at the top of the league table when it comes to what really matters for people. And of course, GDP doesn't really capture either of those directly. It does clearly correlate quite a lot with employment, so that's a reasonably good thing. It's a good proxy for that. And it actually correlates quite well with health as well. So if we look at across a number of different countries and over time, then essentially GDP on the x-axis actually correlates very well with health outcomes on the y-axis, and I'm not sure why this video is not playing, but never mind. It'll happen in a minute. Of course, those of you with eagle eyes will have spotted that I'm cheating on two counts here. First of all, we're looking at GDP per capita. So that's the first adjustment we have to make when we look at GDP growth rates. Is it just growing because we've got more people, or is the well-being or economic welfare of individuals improving because per person GDP is growing? But the second cheat factor here is that I've taken the log of GDP on the bottom axis. And of course, what that means is that as countries and people get richer, extra amounts of GDP add less and less to their well-being. It still adds to their well-being, but at a, you know, increasingly small marginal rate. If you do a similar kind of exercise with other metrics of well-being, such as self-reported life satisfaction, you get a very similar picture. So in that sense, GDP is not a really bad proxy. It's not perfect, but it's not bad. The question around economic value, though, I think there is a big problem with GDP, which has already been mentioned. It does not capture consumer surplus. Now, what is consumer surplus? It is the amount of money that I would be willing to pay for something minus the amount of money that I actually pay for it. So we've already mentioned Google Maps. I would probably be willing to pay at least £500 a year for Google Maps. That is value that I get at the moment, but that's not being recorded in GDP. And the example comes up a lot with these sort of free services on the internet. So, for example, Professor Brynjolfsson has estimated that in the US alone, the internet is worth about $100 billion. That's not captured in GDP in any way. But I wanted to give you an example that's got nothing to do with digital, because this consumer surplus stuff is equally real and important in some very, very basic products, such as, let's skip through to this page, UK natural gas market. Quite far away removed from digital goods and services, but nevertheless an important market. So this is just showing you what, in a particular day, on a particular winter's day, the supply and demand curves for UK wholesale natural gas looked like. So on the supply side, there were a bunch of different sources of gas. The owners and the producers were willing to sell those things at different prices depending on their costs and their opportunity costs. And on the right-hand side, there were a bunch of people demanding gas, willing to pay quite a lot for it. The ones willing to pay almost more than 7,000 pence per therm were the people wanting to keep the lights on, because we are actually willing to pay a lot to keep the lights on. And the next lot after that, willing to pay a lot to not have a gas interruption, because if you have one, you have to have an engineer come to your home or your business to actually reinstall or reinstate the gas supply. You don't want that in the winter, because you really don't want to be without hot water and without heat. But then there are a bunch of other people who demand gas that actually are pretty price sensitive. You know, they can switch to coal, they can switch to oil. So if the price of gas goes much above those kinds of figures over here, they're just going to say, no, thank you, I don't want any of this. Now, if we put those two graphs together, as economists, we know we can figure out what the market clearing price for gas that day was, and it turned out to be about 65 pence per therm. And you're like, well, where is the supply curve here? It is actually in there, I can guarantee, because I put it there myself. You just can't see it, because the scales are so dramatically different. So 65 pence per therm, relative to a price that people were willing to pay that was more in the order of 7,000 pence per therm. And when we talk about consumer surplus, this white area here that's not being captured in GDP is actually valuable. I would have been willing to pay 5,000 pence per therm, but I only paid 65. So that's pretty good. And if you look at the difference here, the GDP number that we would get out of this equation is roughly 50 million pounds. But the total economic welfare, when you add up consumer surplus and producer surplus, is more like 6,000 million, in other words, 6 billion pounds, more than 100 times the GDP number. So this consumer surplus stuff is really quite important, and I'll argue later it's becoming more important with more digitization and more customization. The real problem, though, because we know all those issues, we should know all those issues, is if we forget about it and we use GDP for the wrong kinds of reasons and to indicate the wrong kind of thing. And I've got two kind of specific examples here. First of all is when media, or indeed possibly sometimes policymakers, take the numbers out of context. And this is an example from 2014 when, you know, there were a lot of reports about how 2013 had been an incredibly high growth year, and you know how this was the turning point for the UK economy, etc., etc. None of these press reports put this in context. If we do, we might conclude that 2013 maybe wasn't that special in terms of what was going on in terms of GDP growth. And we need to be aware of the trap that we often fall into by looking at the latest numbers and assuming that somehow or another they always have trend-turning information embedded in them. The second issue, which has already been alluded to, is that GDP is an aggregate figure. It kind of looks at the weighted average total of everything we produce in the economy. And if we look at GDP per head, for example, we're just talking about the average person. We're not really understanding what the distribution underneath is, and maybe not everybody is all that well off. And so an example of this, just briefly, is if we look at aggregate GDP per head between UK and some other countries, then we look to be just about as well off as the French. But then no doubt you've heard this thing about, you know, the UK has one of the widest disparities regionally in terms of GDP per head, which probably comes more from a chart that looks like this, or analysis. So we have a couple of regions like Westminster and Tower Hamlets and Camden, where GDP per head is extraordinarily high. So if you take that and you compare it to the lowest region, then we have a huge, huge, massive difference between the best and the worst. But even something like this doesn't really tell you very much, because how many people really live in Camden and Westminster and Tower Hamlets? Well, not that many. So you actually need to dig even deeper and look at the distribution underneath to really start to understand inequality. And this is just one way of looking at it, looking at population density by bucket of different ranges of GDP per capita. And when you look at this, you could argue any one of these countries has the biggest problem, depending on exactly what you're measuring and what you mean by inequality. Then, you know, you can construct all kinds of metrics that might, for example, say that Italy is the worst because they have this kind of very bipolar distribution and lots of people who seem to be quite rich and lots of people who seem to be quite poor. So the point of all of this is, when we're using any metric, we need to be digging into what's underneath it to really understand what's going on, and we need to be clear about what purpose we're putting it into. So finally, how do we modernize GDP for the new world, and what are some of those complementary metrics we want to bring to bear? Well, we've already discussed this, but I wanted to illustrate it with the chart. If we look at the current accounts, they're basically 44% of the SIC codes are dedicated to manufacturing, when only 14% of the non-financial market economy in the UK is manufacturing. That's leaving out financial sector for practical purposes. And so we clearly need to address that balance. But as John has said, we also need to think forward. Let's not just fix yesterday's problems. Let's also try and fix tomorrow's problems. And I'm sure many of you have heard the now famous quote that data is the new oil. Data actually is becoming an input into production in the same way that labor and capital are. And somehow we need to think about how do we capture data as an input into production. And this is not an insignificant issue. My colleagues at the McKinsey Global Institute have looked at global flows of data in the context of trade and concluded that the trade in data, or not really trade, but the flows of data across borders actually have a bigger impact on GDP than the flows of goods. Not flows of goods and services, but if you just take the goods part of that equation, data flowing around the world seems to be having a bigger impact on GDP than just goods. So we can't ignore it, and we do need to start thinking about how do we capture it in how we measure output and how we measure economic prosperity. I'm sure you've also heard this statement, AI is the new electricity. In other words, we are potentially looking at a new general purpose technology in terms of AI and or, you know, associated advanced analytics techniques. So what? Well, it's going to make that consumer surplus problem much bigger, because quality of services and products is going to become much better and much more tailored, so much harder to try and figure out how to price them. But also probably costs are going to go down, which might mean prices are going to go down. And unless we're able to adjust for quality and value appropriately, then that might show up as a lower rather than a higher GDP number. So to sum up, there are many reasons why the way we measure GDP might overestimate or underestimate economic value and economic growth, but we sort of know what those issues are, so let's continue to use it and let's use it sensibly. But we do need to complement it with lots of other things as well that look into things like welfare, that look into things like well-being, happiness, and indeed start to think about economic value and not just what is exchanged in the marketplace. So just like, you know, when you're driving a car, you don't want to just be focusing on the speedometer, but you want to have some other metrics in play as well. You want to know how much fuel you've got left in the tank, and you want to know what the temperature of your motor is, or at least that it's not overheating. GDP is just one metric. And equally, we don't want to fix the GDP metric by trying to cram into it all these other metrics. We don't want a single metric. When I'm driving a car, I kind of separately want to know what's in my fuel tank and what my speed is, etc., etc. I don't want to have some kind of mega index that just gives me one indicator. That's not going to be very helpful in driving in the right direction. So let's not throw out GDP, but let's improve it and let's complement it. Thank you very much.